I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge. And if this is your very first time hearing our show, great news. It's a really simple idea. We've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. We want you to be a part of this show with us, so please tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations and your story ideas at teacherslounge@niu.edu. That's teacherslounge@niu.edu. And on our show today is Casey Miller. She's a music instructor at College of DuPage, director of music at United Lutheran Church in Oak Park, and creator of the musical project Composing the Climate, that uses the emotion of classical music to explore themes around climate change. And we talked about the suggestive power music has, especially when we use it to channel our feelings about a specific thing, like climate. Casey also channels that same power, music as a spiritual guide, in her work at church as well. We talked about her journey learning and teaching music over the years and the teachers who've made a big impact on her, including Beethoven. We talk about all of that and so much more, and of course, listen to some music from Composing the Climate. But first, we have a few more education stories we want to share. Last year, Illinois passed a law to provide free school meals, but they didn't fund it, so it hasn't happened. But many schools do offer free meals to all students, and I went to a school cafeteria to see what that looks like. The executive chef chops onions for a homemade salsa. Around the corner, cooks pinch pizza dough and dishes clang in the sink. A few feet away, hundreds of customers pour in, order, and leave in minutes. Today, they'll serve upward of 1,700 meals. Welcome to the biggest and busiest restaurant in town, DeKalb High School.
Last year we served 1.15 million meals, and we're already trending for more.
That's Mike Chamness. He's the food service manager at DeKalb Public Schools.
Hi, friend. What can I get you today?
That's Tiffany. She's one of the school's food workers, guiding a line of students through her station.
I got two choices for you today. I got my stir fry, and I also got a chili cheese dog.
I'll do stir fry.
All right, friend.
This first rush just started. Students will come through 200 at a time, and it really won't slow down for another 4 hours. And the workers have been prepping this food since 6 a.m. And DeKalb students have a lot of options. There's pasta, a deli, salad, stir-fry, pizza, a Chipotle-style burrito bar, grab-and-go station, and, of course, a daily special. Today, it's the chili dog. There are more options this year thanks to the district's new partnership with food vendor Organic Life. Connor Artiega is the food service director with Organic Life.
We have to offer all five of our components, which are your grains, your meat-meat alternate, your fruit or vegetable, and then your milk. They must take three out of the five for lunch, and one of which has to be a half a cup of fruit or a vegetable.
DeKalb offers free meals to every student, breakfast and lunch, no matter their age or income.
Unfortunately, some of our students, it could be the only meals they get every day, but definitely the healthiest meals.
That's Mike Chamness again, and he says the benefits don't just end there.
Yeah, there's less trips to the nurse's office. A lot of times kids were going to the nurse's office when all it was is they were hungry, you know, so there's less trips to the nurse's office. We have improved behavior in the district.
Most studies show universal meals lead to fewer disciplinary issues and increase academic performance. The food program looks a little different at the middle and elementary schools. For example, they serve breakfast in the classrooms at those levels.
Which also removes that stigma. Everybody's eating at the same time, where before there was an option, well, you can go outside and play with your friends, or you can come in and eat breakfast.
But at DeKalb, universal meals are a relatively new thing. They've been offering them for 4 years. During the pandemic, the federal government allowed all schools to offer free meals, and that expired in 2022. But after many schools, like DeKalb, saw the positives, they couldn't go back. Roxanne Ramage is with the Illinois State Board of Education, and she says it's a trend they've seen across Illinois.
We did see some growth after that pandemic feeding and continuing to support kids, and it's great when the kids can come to school and not have to worry about any of that.
DeKalb qualifies for universal meals through the community eligibility provision. It's a federal program where schools can offer free meals if a certain percentage of students qualify for federal assistance like Medicaid or SNAP.
It was 40% until this school year, and then the federal government changed that, and that reduced that percentage down to 25%.
Now more schools qualify, but Ramage says they haven't seen a big increase in participation. That's because the fewer students who qualify for federal assistance, the lower the school's reimbursement rate, so it's not financially feasible for some schools. Illinois did pass a universal free meals law last year. The problem is that they didn't fund it. The law's sponsor, Maurice West, introduced another bill this year to devote $200 million annually to the program, but it didn't pass. If it does pass at some point, the food staff in DeKalb think it could make a massive difference. They say kids having access to meals every day doesn't just fill their stomachs. It fuels their bodies so they can play tag during recess and powers their brains so they can focus on their homework and builds a foundation for a healthy life. And undergraduate students who participate in research are more likely to stay in school and get their degree faster, but community college students don't have as many research opportunities as their peers at four-year schools, and I got to go to a community college where they do have those experiences. Jasmine Garcia Malagon is in her second year at Waubonsie Community College, training to become a nurse practitioner.
English is not my first language, so I see how my family struggled speaking English in the medical environment. So I want to help the Hispanic people to be more confident in the appointments and all that stuff.
Like many who attend community colleges, she's also a first-generation college student, and she had no idea research experiences would even be an option. And she certainly didn't think, in her first year, she'd be working on cancer research published in a peer-reviewed journal. For those asking, the title is Predicting Neoantigens for Cancer Using Next-Generation IEDB and CDER Tools, and it just published this fall.
I'm first-generation college, so I need to explain to my family that I'm working, but this work is not for my class. It's like extra project. I'm like, no, this is not homework, but it's important. I need to do this.
Garcia Malagon learned about the project from one of her teachers, Waubonsie biology professor Dr. Sheila Vimu. She sees it as an extracurricular built into her courses. It's also a mentored relationship where she helps students realize they don't just study science, they can do science. That, as she puts it, the information they read in their textbooks isn't just passed down by gods.
So for them to have a glimpse that what you see in there is not just written in stone, it is an iterative process that was done by individuals just like them.
Studies show that students who participate in research are twice as likely to graduate in 4 years and 10 times as likely to graduate within 6 years. And low-income, students of color, and first-generation students benefit particularly well. Dr. Vimu's Waubonsie students just won third place at a STEM poster competition for their recently published work. Peace Kujiwan just transferred to Northern Illinois University after finishing at Waubonsie, and she worked on the project analyzing protein sequences.
I believe the research was one thing that opened a big door for me.
She says it helped her get scholarships and prepared her for the NIU nursing program she's in now. Matthew Cattell was another student researcher. He just transferred to the University of Illinois Chicago to finish his degree in biochemistry, and he, like Jasmine and Peace, had no idea this would even be an option.
Especially at community college, it's one of those things that's not really talked about, and it's a bit more difficult to find those resources.
Community college students in general don't have nearly as much access to undergraduate research experiences compared to their peers at four-year colleges and universities. Jim Hewlett is a community college professor and executive director of the Community College Undergraduate Research Initiative. He helps community colleges launch research programs, and when the initiative started more than a decade ago, they only worked with 6 schools. But now they have well over 120 in their network.
We have seen our membership of community college faculty members increase, over the last 5 years.
Lindsay Curry is with the Council on Undergraduate Research. Curry helps instructors, including Dr. Vimu, embed research into their curriculum and secure grants. That way, community college students who often work and support their families while attending school can have more resources to do their research. But Hewlett says there's not a lot of good data on exactly how many community college students do research. For example, a national survey about student engagement asked students at four-year institutions if they've worked on a research project, but...
That same question on the community college survey asked, did you take a remedial math course? In my brain, the people who designed that survey came into that with this assumption that community colleges don't do undergraduate research.
But they do. And these teachers want to make it easier for community college students to find these opportunities. Hewlett says most community colleges who offer research bake it into their classes. It's how you make sure students don't need to look for it. The experiences are just waiting for them. And he says it's not just a fun and interactive way to learn. It's the most effective way. All right, now it's time for my conversation with musician and music teacher Casey Miller. And we start off talking about a recent trip she just had to play chamber music in Germany.
I had 2 weeks to prepare pretty large pieces. So I was playing for like 14 hours a day. And some days we had 4 or 5 coachings each day, which was a lot.
Yeah, that does sound intense. Yeah. Hopefully you've had some time to relax, detox from that.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I got back and then my College of DuPage semester started kind of immediately. So it was a bit of a, but it was still nice to come back to like reality. So, yeah.
Right. That's awesome. Did you get to when you were in Germany, were you guys playing? In my mind, when I picture chamber music in Europe, I'm picturing very old, ornate, beautiful buildings. Were we in any spaces like that?
Yeah, we all lived in a castle.
Okay.
and the performance hall in the castle was very ornate and beautiful, probably exactly what you have pictured in your mind. Yeah, the really, really beautiful Bechstein piano that I fell in love with.
I wanted to start off and talk a little bit about composing the climate and that project. Can you tell folks just a little bit who aren't familiar with it? Can you tell us a little bit about the project?
Sure. The basic concept behind it is that I feel like chamber music, where musicians playing different instruments are playing together, can be a really neat model for interdisciplinary cooperation and emotional processing at the same time, both of which I think are necessary to address climate change. And so I've been working with different composers to write pieces for piano and strings or any other instruments or voice that they choose. To give their musical take on climate change. With that.
And it's something that kind of started with your dissertation, right?
Yeah, well, so there's different ways that performance doctoral students produce their dissertation equivalent, but mine was University of Illinois Option 2, which is a long thesis length paper with a project recital that goes alongside that. And you have to defend both your performance and your writing at the same time. So, yeah.
The interdisciplinary part is fascinating, right? Like this idea of classical music and chamber music being an effective tool to explore ideas and specifically explore like this idea of climate change. I was curious if that was something that, how, you know, you started that process, how that came to you that you thought this would be a really good thing to focus on for that project?
That's a good question. Part of it was really pragmatic, which was that I realized I wasn't okay without playing classical piano, which is the thing I know how to do. And I wasn't okay whenever I thought about climate change, and I thought, like, I need to bring these two together. Like, if I'm going to continue spending hours each day practicing music from the past, then I also need to find a way to bring that to bear when coping with the present. Doing that alone as a solo pianist seemed much less suited to climate change because it's such a communal problem. And so I thought that bringing other musicians into the conversation was the only sensible way to model this challenge.
You know, I want to dive into that and explore all these things. But before we did that, I was curious because, I when I was listening to the music, of course, I was thinking a lot about climate and I was thinking a lot about nature. And, you know, my whole family are runners. And so I do a lot of, trail running and running through forest preserves. And I was just thinking about that music. And I do sometimes like to listen to music while I'm in nature and remind me of things that. And so I was curious. I saw that you grew up in New England, in Maine, right?
From parts of New England. I moved to Maine kind of before college, but yes.
And so I was curious for you if there are some natural places in your life that make you feel very serene and connected to nature. Like, what are the things that you think of?
I think the place that does that for me the most and where I go in my mind, though I haven't been there for a long time in reality, is probably the White Mountains in New Hampshire and the Kankamagus Highway that you drive along to get there, and the waterfalls and the trails that you can see. Yeah.
I just made a trip up to New Hampshire and up to the White Mountains for the first time. I had never been there before until literally a month and a half ago, and found myself at the top of this, these rocks looking out onto these forests and onto the mountains. And it was pouring rain and there was mist and it was just, it was beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that area. And my family would go there kind of once per winter. Also, sometimes we'd go skiing there, but my favorite time was the summer to just go. I mean, I don't really remember that many summits, just the actual woods and the waterfalls were so great for me, so I go there mentally sometimes.
When you're performing sometimes mentally?
Probably not while I'm performing, but when I'm
yeah, you got things to focus on.
Worried about climate change and when I need to go somewhere in nature to reset, that's, if I could just teleport there, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I was thinking about, I think a lot about somewhere around where I grew up, which we have in this, especially since you're in Northern Illinois, you might be familiar with it a little bit, but we've got the Fox River runs through a good amount of Northern Illinois and around where I grew up. And I think about just the forests and I'm I'm in a forest and it's right alongside the water there. And so you can kind of hear those sounds. And so I was doing the same thing while I was listening to the music, at least I was trying to kind of picturing that and taking myself there. And I thought that was really great to be able to use that music to kind of think back about those places that I feel again, really connected to nature in.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. I went to the Fox River for the first time this summer, I think. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it was gorgeous.
Yeah. So as a part of this project, though, I know that you interviewed a number of other musicians and folks that you've performed with and they were a part of the project. And I thought it was interesting that you talk in the dissertation about how the ways that they expressed themes about climate change and kind of their response to that and their emotions were very, very different. And yes, that one of them, I think you write that one of them seeks to evoke an imagined musical landscape while the other musically represents human achievement and ponders its decay and erosion. And I think that was particularly fascinating too, because I was thinking about it and I know that they are focusing on both of these things, right? But the imagined landscape and then the decay, right? When we think about climate change, of course, we think about this conversation we're having about the places that we feel most connected to and the beauty of nature. But then we also think about the decay and mourning the potential loss of those places.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. I think moving forward with the three totally different composers I'm working with now, you'll see a lot of similar variety where some is focused on depicting sort of almost a visual narrative of what's going to happen to the world as the climate changes, coupled with a more introspective approach of how do we mourn something we haven't fully lost yet, but that we are losing, and, and that kind of contrast not just between human achievement and imagined landscapes, but also the outer understanding of the world and what's happening to it alongside this inner, you know, understanding of like, what are we losing? What's going to happen to me or to people I care about as these things deteriorate is like another sort of pairing that's showing up in their work.
In one of the conversations, they were talking about, you know, when you're using music to evoke these ideas and talking about using different musical techniques to, you know, evoking like, you know, flowers of all different kinds blooming. And they were talking about being inspired by like Hayao Miyazaki movies and mm-hmm. how like yes. beautiful and like lush that nature appears in, you know, in those animated films. And I was thinking about that same thing, too, about when I, you know, like associating music from those movies with, you know, nature and the environment. And again, I know that in your the other conversation, that one of them that you talk about in the dissertation with Sam Sharp, he's talking about like grappling with the limits of music and, you know, trying to depict certain things without relying too much on non-musical elements. And like, right, like with Miyazaki movies, obviously, like we're literally seeing nature in the movies.
Yes.
And that pairing that alongside the music, obviously it's easier to make those connections. And obviously, you know, you can do, you know, written pieces, you can, you know, spoken word, which is a big part of, you know, doing those interludes as part of the project as well. And it is really interesting to try to kind, you know, you want to make sure that the audience has enough context about what, you know, what we're trying to evoke, what themes we're trying to talk about, what you'd like them to examine, but also trying not to, you know, trying to do a little bit of show, not tell too much, where you're, you know, you want to leave some room for interpretation, but, you know, you're also, there are limits to how music alone can do those things.
Absolutely. And I know for like me personally, the suggestive power of music has always been really helpful when I'm feeling a lot of turmoil. You know, like it doesn't tell me exactly what I should be seeing or smelling or tasting, but it does suggest so much that then can take root inside me and help me process whatever it is that needs processing. So I think for me personally, that's my hope for all these pieces, no matter how directive the composers are or aren't, is that they suggest enough so that it can take on a new life and whoever's listening to it and participating in that way and allow them to work through whatever comes up.
Have you had any moments so far where during the or after the performances, either for you, for the other musicians, or for anyone in the audience, that really kind of the themes that you guys were working with and the topics you were trying to talk about really like hit home, and you're like, you know, even it's very subjective, but the things that we're here to talk about and issues like climate and the environment, the things really shine through and you're like, we kind of, it's working, we did it.
Yeah. No, that really did happen for me after the first performance. Someone who I didn't know particularly well, but who I had some connection with in like the real world had come to listen and she commented, and I'm paraphrasing, but that basically she felt like, yeah, in order to do her day-to-day life and like go to work and drive her kids where they needed to be and show up in the ways she needed to show up for like her life, she didn't really have time to like sit and think about climate change because she just then wouldn't be able to do all those things or meet those commitments. And she felt like having that like couple of hours to just sit with it on purpose was really powerful and helpful for her and also very depressing. But she, you know, she felt like that really did carve out a space for her to say, all right, this is going to be heavy and difficult, but there's this music to support it and this space to support it. And I'm just going to sit down and let it happen and be glad for this space to do it in, because that's not usually available to me. So,
yeah. And I don't remember which of the musicians, if it was Sam Sharp or if it was any of the ones that were talking about, like music acting as like a spiritual guide for these sorts of things. Cause I think about, like, a lot of times, like that person mentioned, like, we just don't have, you know, a couple hours carved out specifically to focus on these things. Even if, like, climate change is something that we know intellectually is a huge deal and a cause that we really care about, It's just not often that we have like a 2-hour space that we carve out specifically to sit and think and reflect on those things. And just having that space is probably really helpful to, again, start considering that. And then music can really kind of act as a conduit through that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was really my hope for the, like, my original version of this series would have had like some kind of therapist or guide or some sort of facilitator to like make that really intentional. And I haven't really made that version of this concert yet. Maybe it will happen at some point, but I think that really, if you just, you know, suggest, again, like using the power of suggestion, suggest to people that they use this time for this purpose, like it's not forced. And if they process other things, like that's cool too. But I think, yeah, most people, if you give them the space and the intention, are going to just let that happen.
Right. And, you know, that actually, it reminds you a lot of some other work that you do, which is that you're a music director at a church also. And like, that's kind of similar, right? Like you're carving out a very intentional time of your week to reflect on certain parts of your life. And what you do there is kind of similar in the way that you're using music kind of as a conduit to get people to feel those things.
Yeah. I mean, the big difference I think between those two is the specificity of the text that people sing when they go to a worship service in that way. But yeah, but the connection was very much present in my mind when I started coming up with this concept for composing the climate. I originally wanted to call it a liturgy in some sense. But I realized that had too much of like a specific religious connotation for people. But when I think of like liturgy at its best, it's just like this pattern that you offer people to move through different phases of their spiritual processing in kind of a gentle order. And you just trace through that pattern every time you show up to that space and see what happens in you when you do that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that, you know, I'm someone, I grew up in church. I don't think that my church that I grew up with had a music director, had someone solely dedicated it. For people that don't know 100% what goes into that work on kind of a week-to-week basis, can you talk a little bit about, you know, that intentionality or just that work of composing, you know, music for that setting?
Well, I'm largely relying on other people's compositions.
Sure, sure. I think I meant composing literally as in like composing the service itself. Right. The storytelling. Yeah.
Yes. But the storytelling is kind of reliant on the text that's, you know, prescribed for that day. And so it's kind of a matter of going through the resources for the church that I work for and saying like, all right, what texts from, you know, their scriptures are we using, and how do we pair that with texts and tunes from their hymnal collection or their whatever music resources they have, and how do I structure that so that it flows, and also what's going to be singable, right? Like what do they already know as a group how to sing, what could they learn how to sing very, very quickly without struggling, because I never want the focus to be on like, can we do this, you know, but rather we are doing this, and so yeah, I try to be really mindful of the balance between like comfort music that probably these people grew up with, which I'm often speculating on since I did not grow up in this particular church or with these particular people, but you know, what do they already feel great about singing? And then can I push the envelope a little bit by adding something that might have really relevant text for their theme that day, but that they might not already know the tune for, if that makes sense.
No, definitely. Well, and you talk about like, you know, what they grew up maybe singing or doing in church. I know that a lot of folks that, you know, play music grew up and like kind of that started for them performing music in church. Is your story similar to that? Is that a place that you started playing music or maybe not?
Yeah, I moved a lot as a kid. And so my family was very religious. So we went to many different churches. It was kind of interesting because when I was really young, like 9, 10, I did play in church, and it was like, it kind of fit with whatever that church was doing. The churches that my family attended became sort of more and more, they relied more on like amplified music, I guess, as I, you know, became more capable at the piano. I felt like my piano skills were less relevant to the churches that my family attended. And so it was kind of a relief to me after grad school to find out that there were still churches that relied on like acoustic keyboard players, because I mean, that's what I can do, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think about, like, I grew up in a Southern Baptist church, and like they, like, it was mainly you just kind of sing out of a hymnal, and there was maybe one piano player, but there wasn't like a multitude of different instruments that were being played, even amplified or not.
Yeah.
It was mainly just like a group of folks singing out of a book. And I remember when I, my brother is also a Lutheran pastor, and I remember going to one of their services, and they had like a whole Bach cantata going on, and it was completely foreign to me. I had no idea that there were churches that performed that kind of music, and you know, having chamber or, you know, again, just for lack of a better term, classical music be a part of the church atmosphere was something that I hadn't experienced before, and it was really like kind of blown away by it.
Yeah, and that, like, there's a whole gamut of what happens in churches, especially in the Midwest, which is kind of cool for me being, you know, not from here. I'm like, whoa, some of these churches take their music very seriously. I'd say like I found like a good fit for me, which is like we don't have a whole orchestra or anything like that, but it's sort of an organic approach of like, oh, we know this person plays this instrument, so if they want to play sometime, that's great, you know. Or like the other week we had a teenager from a group like play the bongos on an assembly song that needed some percussion, you know. It's just like, but that doesn't happen all the time, so it's kind of chill,
right? Yeah. Come as you are. If you've got bongos, bring the bongos.
yeah exactly.
Now I think that we've mentioned also that you are also a music teacher, and that you teach at College of DuPage and do private lessons as well. Mm-hmm. At College of DuPage, is it a lot of one-on-one kind of instruction there, or is it more, you know, classes with, you know, a range of different students?
At College of DuPage, it's classes with a range of different students, for the most part. Usually, I've had some smaller classes, but usually around like 15 students or so all at once.
Okay. Yeah. What classes are you teaching?
This semester, just oral skills one.
Oh, wow.
And dictation, yeah.
Wow, so are you really early, I imagine, in the semester right now? Has that started?
Yeah, we're entering our fourth week.
Wow. Yeah. Well, how do you start? Like, what are some good, like, you know, first couple weeks things that you're trying to hit to, you know, make everyone A, feel like comfortable in the classroom and try to build some of those fundamentals?
Well, I start by trying to make sure everyone knows what we're trying to do, because I think it's a really unique class in that we're both trying to sing melodies we've never seen before using a solfège system that some people usually have some familiarity with, and some people are like, what are we doing? So we have to explain sort of our framework for how we're singing, and then also introduce a framework for like, how do we write with a pencil, which is actually not something students today do as much in general.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Do we write on staff paper with a pencil? How do we procure staff paper? Or can we draw very, very tiny parallel lines on notebook paper? And usually we throw that out after a couple weeks. And so just kind of trying to like make sure everyone's on board with like those really basic frameworks of like how to sing on solfège and how to bring materials that will help you write down notation in real time as you hear someone play a melody or a rhythm on the piano. Because those aren't skills that are really developed pre-college for a lot of students today. Some are, especially if they've had AP music theory, but many students are just like, yeah, music is cool. I'll take music classes. And then they're like,
I was going to say, like, what are we doing? Like in your classes right now are like, is it a little bit of both of some people going in who want to pursue music as a career and some of the people who come in because, you know, music is cool and I want to learn more about it?
I think it's kind of a mix, but even music as a career is pretty varied. You know, if you are going to study music at a community college and you want to be a producer of some kind, like seeing a link between what you want to do as a producer and being asked to solfège Haydn string quartets with your own voice in a classroom of people might feel really strange to you.
Right. Yeah. How do you, and this is a challenge for all teachers and all classes, but I think there's something specifically with music and even specifically more so with singing that there's a certain kind of vulnerability to it, that trying to create a classroom where people feel both like kind of secure enough to be able to try things, but also, you know, feel like they're being pushed and they're being challenged is kind of a difficult balance to strike for a teacher.
Yeah, it is. And I try to just name that from day one, like, this is not a class where you can hide, you know, and I know that's terrifying sometimes. But let's do our best to be really supportive of each other when we sing. And alongside that, I think there's really strength in numbers with singing. So while eventually I need to evaluate everyone individually, we really do work as a group early on in the semester and throughout, you know, especially when we're warming up at the beginning. I have everyone stand around the piano so that no one's, you know, sitting down or hiding, and also so that they're really supported if they haven't had as much experience singing by like people singing right next to you. And I think that does require a lot of vulnerability, but I also think it requires students to be present in a physical space and in their own bodies and with other bodies in a way that a lot of educational experiences don't require today. And I think that's really powerful and difficult, but I think the power through singing right next to someone is pretty hard to replace with any other type of activity.
Right. And singing kind of forces you to be, and this is a pun very, very intended, in tune with your own body in a way that maybe other subjects don't physically require that in the same way.
Yeah. And that is difficult. And, you know, and I also really emphasize, like, this is a skill we're building. It's not
right.
A natural talent. It's not oral natural talent or yeah. And so I hope that gets communicated clearly.
Yeah. How many years have you been teaching music? As you know, obviously you've been performing music, I imagine, since you were a kid, but how long have you been teaching?
I've been teaching for a long time. I started teaching piano lessons when I was still a teenager. I think I'm a much better piano teacher now than I was when I was.
Do you remember those first ones where you were a teenager and you're like, you feel like you know what you're doing enough, but you're also like, man, I'm a teenager and I'm in control and I'm the authority figure in this situation. Do you remember those early lessons?
Yeah, I do. I think I didn't understand what might be like so easy for me would be something that really needed to be built, you know, in other people. Not that the piano was easy for me. The piano is definitely something that I had to build, but music literacy, like, I don't really remember learning how to read notation. It just made sense to me. And then I was like, okay, I can read notes now. Actually playing the piano is something that's been a lot more of a journey and like a growing process for me. So I feel like the teaching the piano part has always made sense to me in my head, but teaching literacy was really something I had to study and practice and develop.
Yeah, it's like anything else, right? Like I think about it as compared to like sports, that famously some of the best like basketball players in the world end up after they retire trying to be coaches, and they're really terrible at it. Yeah. 'Cause, and we do have an assumption often that the people who are, you know, considered the best in a certain discipline or a certain skill or art or sport are like inherently going to be good at communicating and teaching that information, and that's often not the case at all. And it is hard, right? Because like you have to put yourself in the place of other people where like, you know, some things might not come as easy to them as they came to you. Some things might come easier to them than they even came to you when you were learning it at first.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And I think even as a teenager, some of that made sense to me. I just didn't know as a teenager how to really scaffold and explain concepts that hadn't ever been explained to me, you know, that just like, yeah, because my own early learning was pretty haphazard. And my teachers were just kind of like, oh, you're a good reader. So yeah, you can play this and this and this. And I just ate it up like, oh, cool. The sky's the limit. I can play anything. And of course, it didn't sound very polished, but I could definitely read it.
Do you feel like teaching has made you a better musician?
Probably. I think it's definitely made me a musician who learns to be kind to myself in a way that I didn't learn from many of my teachers, because I think that what I hope for all of my students is that I'm fostering their ability to love and own the sounds that they make at their instrument, and to really listen to themselves when they're playing, and to love what they hear even as they're growing it and improving it. And I feel like in order for me to do that, I've had to really overcome a lot of self-criticism and to kind of learn to move through some really harsh voices in my head from my own development from past teachers. So I think that in that sense, being a teacher has made me a much better musician.
You've talked about how you started playing piano and doing music at a young age. Was it something that clicked into place for you early on, that music is something that, you know, maybe you would want to pursue and maybe you'd want to keep doing for the rest of your life and maybe do professionally? Or was that something that just developed over time?
I wasn't a particularly young piano beginner for someone who's a professional pianist. But when I was maybe 6 or 7, I had my first exposure to a keyboard, which was like a little 3 or 4 octave keyboard at my great grandma's condo. And I thought that was like the most fun thing I'd ever had access to. And
Also funny that 6 or 7 is not particularly young.
Well, I still didn't have one at home, you know. And
okay,
so,
yeah,
and
true.
So it took a little while. Yeah. But that, no, it's not particularly young too, because it's such a physical and gymnastic, you know, activity.
Right.
And developing that really young is helpful. But yeah, I think in my mind, like playing the piano was connected with the person of my great grandma and her making me Jiffy Pop and, you know, like having, feeling safe and nice and getting to make noise and take up space that way. And so I begged my parents for a piano, and it took them a little while, but they got one. And I really did like playing the piano. I don't think that it crossed my mind as something someone could do professionally until I was in high school. And my teacher was like, hey, you could take some college classes for this. And I was like, really? And yeah, sort of because of that teacher, I realized I could graduate from high school much earlier than anticipated and just matriculate at the university near me and become a music major. And that's how I realized you could do music professionally.
Wow.
So it was a bit haphazard.
Now that is a perfect segue to another question, and it's kind of the foundation that this show is built on, that kind of everyone has had a teacher who helped them become who they are, helped them, you know, just grow, someone that really, really made a big impact on them. You mentioned that teacher. Who are some of the folks that maybe come to mind when you start thinking about the teachers or educators, anyone that falls under that umbrella that either, again, really taught something to you about yourself or just had a big impact on you?
Well, there are so many, and there will probably continue to be more in the future, because I think as a professional musician, like, we're always evaluating and learning and seeking guides and mentors. And especially in classical piano, it's like everyone can trace their teacher to Beethoven, or something. So I guess ultimately we can say thank you to Beethoven. But no, that teacher, Robert Glover, was a huge influence. I think he was the first maybe adult to take me seriously as like someone who could have a professional life of any kind, and who really helped me listen to the sound I was going to make just before I was going to make it, instead of right after I had already made it, which made it very big difference. That split second of difference really changed everything for me. I think that he had already kind of developed arthritis and didn't perform professionally himself anymore. But when I was at Eastman, my teacher, Rebecca Pennies, was amazing for being able to just say, like, do this. And she'd just sit at the piano next to you and do it. And then all of a sudden you could do it too. And it was incredible, because it's very hard to explain to someone how that's possible, but it's true. Like, you could wrestle with an etude all week and then go see her, and she'd be like, no, this way, and just do it. And then you could also do it, which was really incredible to me, to like, not only as a pianist, but just to realize that we really need each other to say, no, look, this is not only possible, but it's doable, and it's doable for me, and it's also doable for you. And I think that's really transmitting information through that like kinesthetic proximity to someone is really special. And then more recently, the teacher I had at the end of my doctoral studies, William Hylas, who is here in Illinois, I think was really, really added something to my understanding of my own performance by just really calling me to listen to whatever aspect of these multi-layered pieces I wasn't fully hearing. And so that could be something obvious like the melody, as silly as that sounds, but it's easy to lose track of something so simple when you're actually trying to learn a very long piece. But often would be some like rhythmic inner voice that had escaped my notice as I was trying to learn a million notes in a short period of time. And his constant call to like hear really made so many things possible for me at the piano that I think would have taken me so much longer to find without that call to listen and love what I was hearing and honor every oral layer of every piece.
You know, it's awesome and fascinating that you mentioned like that we kind of, all the teachers owe something to Beethoven, and we can go back to think that, because that's something that I've been framing this question around lately after someone else, a different professor that I interviewed a couple months ago. I was asking that same question about like teachers you've had in your life that have made a big difference, and just educators in general. And he was talking about like, yeah, like obviously there's the teachers and educators I've had, but there's also like, you know, the movies I've watched that have taught me something about myself or taught me something important, or, you know, the music that I've listened to in my life that has really taught me a lot, even if I didn't directly have that, you know, Beethoven in the classroom with me personified, that like, yeah, so much in our life can teach us about ourselves, including, you know, music that we listen to.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like the whatever repertoire I'm currently working on, like, always sets the tone for all the other encounters and information I take in during a period of time. And there are years that I don't remember by year, but rather by oh, that was when I was working on Chopin Fourth Ballade. So
that was the year of Chopin.
that is my context for the things that happened at that time.
What context are we in right now with that?
Right now we are in the Kreisleriana and Beethoven Opus 101 phase. Yeah.
Right. I'm sure that colors the way you look at the world outside of music too.
Always, yes.
I only have a couple more questions for you, Casey, and they're ones that we always like to end off on. And I'll have one of them that's more generally related to teaching and one that gets more specific into music. But is there something just about teaching that you think is more important than people might realize who don't teach?
Well, this is maybe specific to teaching private music lessons, but I think, and I especially noticed this in college students who maybe haven't had private lessons before, that there's something really powerful about being one-on-one with a student and being physically in the same space as a student, sort of like I was saying about, you know, the teacher who made me feel it was possible to do things because she was sitting right there and could do them. I think it's really easy to lose that with physical distance, with Zoom, even though, of course, we're meeting this way right now. But I think that energy that is shared between people when they're having a one-on-one lesson like that is really conducive to learning, even though it also requires a different level of vulnerability that sometimes needs to be developed over years. I've had private students who wouldn't directly engage with me for maybe three semesters, and then all of a sudden they open up and they can answer and talk. But I think building that trust is really developmentally important for kids and really healing for adult students, and really a unique but challenging aspect of teaching private music lessons.
And then a similar question, which is there something about teaching and learning music specifically that you just wish more people knew?
That's a good question. What do I wish more people knew?
Yeah, we could say this, and since the other one was about teaching, about, I guess, learning music. Is there something about...
I think I wish more people knew how powerful it is to practice away from your instrument, how powerful it is to carry the music, no matter how simple or complex, with you where you go throughout your day when you're not consciously working on it. And I wish more people would really develop that and really internalize the rhythms and the tunes and the harmonies of what they were working on, because I think that adds so much richness to our lives when we do that. And I think it's really to overlook.
Is that a skill that you build?
It can be. I think some people just do it, but I think, I think you can absolutely build this ability to like craft an artistic picture of your piece, whether it's an 8-measure tune in a beginner book or a 25-page sonata.
Well, Casey, that was pretty much all I had for you. And thank you so much for making the time to talk about your work and all this stuff. I'm really glad that we got to find the time to do this.
Oh, thanks. Likewise.
That was musician and music teacher Casey Miller. Thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always, feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests like Casey. Send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. And please continue to send your story ideas as well. Wherever you're hearing the podcast, subscribe, leave us a rating, or share it with a friend. If you like what we do, it's the best way to get even more interesting teachers, even more perspectives on the show. You can subscribe to our Teacher's Lounge newsletter over at wnij.org to keep up to date with everything going on with the show. A big thank you to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of this show. And I've been your host, Peter Medlin, and we'll be back with more Teacher's Lounge very soon. See ya.